Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly. Hey ho, it's another big week in everybody's favourite game. In the Champions League, the big showdown at Stamford Bridge as Chelsea take on Inter. Pouting Portuguesa versus Cuddly Carlo. Who will win? Beckham's Achilles tendon drama. David may never reach the pitch again, say doctors, just like his wife. Premier League, make mine a pint of hindsight. Phil Brown is out after boating mishap put sinking hull further up that creek. Podcast, he was asking to go home 10 months ago at the KC. What took them so long? Elsewhere, there's news from Spain, Italy and the Bundesliga, your post and a special focus on the top four battle. All of that in today's Football Weekly. Joining us today, we have controversial blogger Rob Smythe, author of Sunday Night's Incendiary, Beckham, Hobble Off and Stop Bothering Me, you get piece on the Guardian website.
Hello, James.
Hi, Rob. I have to say, I'm really, I do apologise in advance because Rob's been up all night, so there's no telling where this might go.
Yeah, I should stress it was sadly for cricket purposes, not because I have anything resembling a life, but yes.
Right.
Apologies in advance.
Right. The part of the proper journalist in today's production will be played by Owen Gibson.
Hello, Owen. Hello.
Thank you for leaving your article about Portsmouth. Raphael Honigstein, also from the world of serious journalism.
I don't know about that.
Oh, come. Anyway, Chelsea Inter. It's the big thing, isn't it, really?
It's pretty big. Although, is anything bigger than the David Beckham story in the world right now?
All right, sure. Well, the Portsmouth issue, of course, but
yeah,
we're coming to that later.
It is a fascinating game for all sorts of reasons. Of course, the players, most of the Chelsea players have tried very hard to say, look, but this is not about Mourinho, we're playing Inter. And we're actually 2-1 down, so we can't afford to talk about the past too much. And I think it's a tricky, really tricky tie. I mean, Inter obviously had a terrible run in Serie A, as you know, and I'm sure will tell us more about later in recent weeks. So Chelsea must be favourite still at 2-1.
But Do you think
it's going to be? Yeah, of course.
I don't know. I think that the Anglo-Italian clash last week at Old Trafford
it was close.
But I think this is going to be a very different. I think maybe that skews people's perceptions of the respective strengths of Inter and Chelsea. I'm generally not very optimistic when an Italian club for the Italian sides when they face English teams. But in this particular case, I think I felt before the first leg that Inter have a decent chance, and I think they're in a very good position right now. I know that Chelsea, when they focus and when they concentrate, when they have a task in front of them, as indeed in the second half against West Ham at the weekend, they are a phenomenal footballing team.
I think that's right, but Chelsea also looking quite weak, not weak, but less strong defensively than they have done previously.
Less strong.
yeah, journalistically.
But Ross Turnbull in goal, is that part of your qualms for them?
Well, I think given that he's replacing Hilario, probably not.
Rob?
I was going to say, do you not need to have shots to trouble a goalkeeper? I don't see Inter. I just don't see them having any influence on the game at all, really. I don't know how they're going to get a grip on midfield. I thought at home the midfield was overrun. I went into that game really fancying Inter and Mourinho, but I was so disappointed. I thought they were rubbish, even though they won.
Even though they won 2-1.
Yeah, and I think Chelsea will trounce them 3-0, maybe.
Well, Chelsea would justifiably claim to have been owed a penalty.
Yeah, there's been a collusion of... had a penalty, and whoever it was, I forget, should have been sent off. But even without thinking of that, just Chelsea, I thought, dominated the midfield quite comfortably. And I know that's partly dictated by the fact Inter scored early, but I don't see how that flimsy midfield is going to get a grip on people like Lampard and Malouda, who's playing really well at the moment. I just don't see it happening.
I think it's going to be a much less open game than the first one was, and I think that'll suit Inter.
But what happens if Chelsea start fast and score in the first 15 minutes? What happens then to Inter? What do they do? Where do they go?
But that's going to be key, isn't it? I mean, first goal, obviously.
I agree with Rob to a certain extent, because I too fancied Inter before the first leg, but was actually a little bit disappointed with the way they played, and I think Chelsea did enough to get away with an equaliser and we're a bit unlucky to come away with a 2-1 defeat. So based on that, I still think, as I said before, that Chelsea are in a decent position.
And as much as everyone tries to claim it's not about Mourinho, of course it is all about Mourinho, and he'll be trying his best to make it all about Mourinho, won't he? He'll probably be slightly gutted to see Beckham on the back pages tomorrow rather than him.
And yeah, he was very quiet in the first in and around the first game, which was fairly unusual. It'll be interesting to see if he tries to whip it. I don't know if that's in their best interest or not, really, to try and make it about him and distract the focus or just go on with the game. I'm not sure. It'll be interesting to see.
We shall see. I mean, certainly this is a tie that could go either way, but I think it will be a close affair. And yes,
huge game for Ancelotti, obviously. You know, kind of if it was to happen and they were to go out, then
But also 2 points. How big is it for Mourinho in terms of what he was brought in, and how big is it for Serie A? I know you think that's the kind of reports of Serie A's demise have been exaggerated, but no, if they were to be hammered, say 3-0, what message would that send?
After last week,
it would be a further proof that the big four, that the top teams in England, are a level above anybody in Europe.
Even Barcelona?
I think even possibly Barcelona. I don't know. I mean, last year's meeting was, shall we say, inconclusive, given that the refereeing played a large part in Chelsea's exit in the semi-final. I don't think I'm saying anything too controversial.
No, I agree with that, and yet they completely obliterated United in the final. Well, yeah, admittedly, United without Fletcher, I understand that, but I mean, it was humiliating, essentially.
Well, they're all interesting questions. I mean, certainly Barcelona, right? Maybe we'll say top three plus Barcelona. And maybe Inter can join that club. Maybe they can prove they belong in that company. I don't know. You have to say, Rafael, you're mentioning their rotten time of it of late. I mean, not just in the Champions League, where they've gone out at this stage the last 3 years and the last 2 years, as we all know, to English opposition. But I think the performance against Chelsea at the San Siro, whilst it may not have been convincing for many of us, did suggest a level of strength and a threat to this team that they didn't show against Manchester United. They didn't show against Liverpool either. But they are coming into this game fresh from a 3-1 defeat at Catania, and have only won once in their last six games in Serie A, throwing away a massive Serie A lead. They're now only 1 point ahead of Milan.
It's not the best type of preparation.
I think it is, actually.
I agree.
Yeah.
There have been other examples of teams who, when they've essentially won the league by February, kind of aren't in that level you need to be at to play in European competition. Whereas if you are struggling for points, even if you're losing, at least you're kind of, every game's a challenge and you're at a level you need to be. I think that's probably better than being, because pretty much Inter have won the league by February in the last few years.
There's battling for points and there's getting hammered 3-1.
That's very true.
It was a bizarre game, actually. They went a goal up, and then Muntari got himself sent off, came on, and within 80 seconds was off again after picking up two yellow cards.
So for all Mourinho's much-vaunted skill of picking the right substitution,
it didn't work out for him. And then Catania, who've been on fire since Sinisa Mihalovic took over as manager, stormed past him with three goals and in 15 minutes. And there you go. But I think a large part of that is the fact that Inter have their minds on this tie Tuesday night at Stamford Bridge. And this year they do have, in previous years Inter, they've always fluffed the big occasions. This year they had to win the final group game, they did. They had to get a decent result in the home match against Chelsea. Yeah, maybe it wasn't the best performance. I maybe was a little bit overexcited about it straight after. But yeah, they are ahead in this tie. Anyway,
and if Mourinho is positioning himself for returns to Premier League, you know, maybe Man City, maybe Liverpool, then obviously it's important for him from that point of view as well, you know.
Absolutely. Now, there you go. That's the clash Tuesday night at Stamford Bridge. In the meantime, Chelsea, of course, are very much in the thick of the title race in the Premier League. They lie a point behind, 2 points behind Man United, but with a game in hand. Now, Rob, last week you were talking about Arsenal winning the title as a done deal. Do you still feel that way?
I do, even more so because of Saturday. I think kind of you take strength from certain things in a title race. Lucky wins, late wins. Arsenal ticking all the boxes. At Stoke, they got a sympathetic penalty, which put them 2-1 up and won that game. I don't know what minute it was, but it was certainly an injury time on Saturday. A dreadful mistake, really, from Myhill. So they win there. Absolutely. If you look at their running, it's just so much easier. And I think they have good players to come back. As Wenger pointed out, they were missing almost their entire spine on Saturday. Gallas, Fabregas, Van Persie. I said astonished last week, which was a bit absurd, but I'd be extremely surprised if they didn't win the league, personally.
Really? Even though Man United are ahead and a...
Yeah, but it's just a case of the fixtures. United have Chelsea for a start, so points will be dropped there. But they also have Liverpool, which they've lost three in a row to them. Chelsea have Liverpool away, which is a really hard game at any time. Arsenal have none of these fixtures. They do have Tottenham and City, but Tottenham, as we've seen, can't really handle the pressure of needing to beat Arsenal. And City will be at the Emirates, where Arsenal are pretty formidable, except against the very best side. So
you're sleep deprived, so I'll forgive you for this. But you're suggesting that Tottenham, for example, won't cause more of a problem than facing this Liverpool team?
No, absolutely not. Tottenham can't. We've seen this so many times when Tottenham have needed to beat Arsenal, whether for their own purpose or to deny Arsenal, they just can't handle it. And I, while they might take a point off them, I don't really see them troubling them. No.
Well then, for United, it all depends on Rooney staying fit, doesn't it? You know, I think if he stays fit, which is a big ask given the fixture list, as you say, then you know, I think it's hard to look beyond them. But
Rooney with a big ask.
In a strange right. way, it will. Arsenal don't really, it will benefit the other teams if Arsenal stay in Europe. If they get Chelsea or United and go to the quarterfinals, I think it just increases their chances in the league.
Raphael, what about the fact that if the teams finish tied on points, and it's so tight between them right now that it could well do, it'll come down to goal difference. In Man United there, the goal difference of 46, a full 8 more than Arsenal, who of course with Robin Van Persie out and with Nicholas Bentner are somewhat handicapped in that race.
Yeah, they haven't actually been, by their standards, been playing that attractive and free-flowing football this season, Arsenal, but they've done enough to pick up the points against the smaller teams, where, of course, they've been really found out and found wanting against the big sides. And maybe is enough, as Rob said, to just keep on winning against the lesser sides and be a flat-track bully. I'm not so sure. I think that I remember all too vividly what happened last season when they had this fantastic run after winter break and then got knocked out by United in the semi-finals and completely collapsed the last few games. And I can easily see a similar scenario where they'll suffer heavy defeat against a better team in the quarterfinals, and then all the confidence goes. Arsenal are a confidence team because of the way they play.
But they've already had those defeats this season, and now they're looking stronger and more confident than ever. They've already been beaten by all
that. That is very true. But it does take some time to turn it around. Mm. The last defeat was a few months ago, a few weeks ago at least, and they've been haven't really been influenced by that anymore. But I think at the business end of the season, where every game becomes very, very big, you suffer a big defeat. You saw what happened last year. They really fell apart.
Do you see anyone between now and the end of the season who are going to give them that big defeat? Do you think in the Champions League?
I think it could very well come in the Champions League, and I think it could very well influence the rest of the season. I mean, the fact that that Wenger didn't play Fabregas against Porto really shows that he thinks that they've got a really good chance to win it this year. So, of course, you have to take them very seriously, and they were one of my favourites before the start of the season. But I still think that United and both United and Chelsea have a bit more when it comes to getting those must-win games.
Right. Interesting. In the meantime, Saturday's result had a plenty of impact on Hull, who have now released. What exactly technically has happened here? They've put Phil Brown
on gardening leave, which is a bizarre formulation of words. That's their formulation of words. It's an odd thing. It's an odd thing for a football club to come out and say after sacking their manager.
So has he been offered a job somewhere else? Is that the implication?
But that's generally what happens when someone's on gardening. Unless he genuinely is gardening. I don't know. That might be what's happening.
Gardening and karaoke clearly is. But it is odd because Adam Pearson returned to Hull as chairman back in November, I think it was now, for his sort of second spell as chairman. And there was a lot of speculation around then about whether Phil Brown would be on his way out. And he sort of backed him then. And it's just deeply odd timing, which leads you to think there must be something else behind it other than just results.
What kind of thing?
Punch up in a park, maybe in front of the Women's Institute. I don't know. I think it's really sad, and I agree with Owen, because Pearson came back in and we were told that Brown was told basically to kind of tone it down and behave, and he essentially did that. He got some good results. They were in a bit of trouble, but the whole city, what do you expect? They just played really well against Arsenal with 10 men. I think it's quite sad, really.
Mm. And what would we do for sort of bizarre training incidents without
kind of David Brent of the Premiership has gone, sadly.
I think really is a classic case of results and of a lack of confidence in his managerial ability. I mean, you look at the bottom of the table, and it is only one win or two that's going to make the difference. And if you can get that bounce that you often get from a new manager, then this move will have been justified. Obviously, it is a last resort, especially so late in the season, but I think it's maybe just what they needed.
And like quite a few clubs in that clutch, they have got, you know, they are existing on a financial precipice effectively. I mean, their last accounts showed that they were in some trouble financially, and if they drop down to Championship, that it will really hit them hard, and you know could start a kind of a knock-on effect of other kind of difficult decisions that have to be made. So obviously that is that classic sort of last ditch gamble to an extent. If you look at the next three games, they've got Portsmouth, Fulham and Stoke, and obviously Portsmouth of them is a huge game.
Indeed. That's probably more than enough for part one. We'll be talking more about the Premier League later on, the race for fourth place. And loads of other stuff, Rob, so well worth staying awake for. Before that, though, we've got Sid in Madrid and loads more Champions League talk.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Now, listeners, our weekly treat, we have Dr. Sid on the line from Madrid. Sid.
Good, you sound pleased to hear from me.
I'm delighted to hear from you, Sid, as every week.
Is there a caveat to that?
There's no caveat to that, Raphael.
Yeah. No?
Raphael, irrepressible German journo Raphael, just can't stop making jokes about everything. Sid, Barcelona are in Champions League action this week. It's a 1-1 result from the first leg, in which they were away to Stuttgart. And they come into the return leg in fine form, especially that man Leo Messi, eh? A hat-trick.
And it was a brilliant hat-trick as well, a really, really special hat-trick. All three goals were superbly taken. He played very, very well indeed. There's a very interesting little factor in all of this, though, which is that it was 0-0 at half-time. I must confess, I didn't manage to see the first half, partly because Andy Gray's last word is apparently more important than the live first half of Barcelona against Valencia. But it does appear that at half-time, Barcelona had not played quite so well. They sent Thierry Henry on at the start of the second half, and he made a real difference. And I must say, I've been thinking this all year that, yes, it's true that Henry's not playing very well, but he does give Barcelona something that no one else in the side gives them, and it really stretches the game out and creates space. That enabled Leo Messi to turn in an absolutely brilliant second-half performance.
Everyone confident there, despite Real Madrid's exit last week, that it's all going to go well for them against Stuttgart?
Well, I really quite like the response of Barcelona to Real Madrid going out. And as you can probably imagine privately, I'm sure they're all pretty cocky about it. But the response from Leo Messi and also from Pep Guardiola is, we've got to look at the Real Madrid game as a warning to all of us that you can't take opponents lightly. You can't go into a Champions League game assuming you're just going to win. Now, of course, it is true that Barcelona believe that they're in a good position, because frankly, they are in a good position. They got the away goal. And while their away form recently has been a little plodding and a little tired, at Camp Nou they're still very, very good indeed. And I think they feel, with some justification, that the tie's in the right place, let's say, for them to go through. And obviously anything that's shorter than a 1-1 draw, and they're still okay.
Well, there you go. Let's talk briefly about Real Madrid, who maintained their first place in the Liga with a 4-1 win at Valladolid. Higuain with a hat-trick there, Ronaldo another one, yes, don't know. But what about the stories about the replacement for Manuel Pellegrini and the fact that it might be top Liverpool tactician Rafa Benitez?
Yeah, well, I think this is something that at the moment is really just in the speculative stage, in the sense that I don't think...
Well, why is it even in the speculative stage?
Because Manuel Pellegrini won't continue next year, of that
right.
I have absolutely no doubt. I think there's one thing that could possibly save Pellegrini now, and that is not only that Real Madrid win the league, but they win the league and absolutely batter Barcelona on the way to doing so. I think that's the only way Pellegrini can turn this around now. Bear in mind that Real Madrid at the start of the season talking about, you know, being the biggest club in the world again. They know that this season is entirely defined by the Champions League. They talked about a treble, and Real Madrid were knocked out by Alcorcon in the Copa del Rey first round, effectively, and knocked out by Lyon in what's considered the first round, because, of course, it was the first knockout stage, the same place as the last 6 years. And that's basically the end for Pellegrini. Also, it's influenced by the fact that he was never Florentino Perez's first choice in the first place. And so that does inevitably put us in a position now where people are talking about potential replacements, one of which is bound to be Rafa Benitez, because, of course, he began his career with Real Madrid.
And he ended it at Liverpool, surely. Why would he be considered for, if you're looking for the best, as Real Madrid undoubtedly are, why would the name Rafa Benitez be considered in that context?
Well, let me defend Rafa Benitez, first of all. From a Spanish point of view, and certainly from a Real Madrid point of view, the obsession is the Champions League. In the 6 years during which Real Madrid have not got through a single knockout tie in the tournament, Rafa Benitez has won one tournament, been to the final, and been to a semi-final as well. Now, frankly, that's a pretty bloody brilliant record compared to Real Madrid's. Now, it is true that things are going wrong at Liverpool now, but I think there's a willingness to to accept some of Benitez's failings and say, well, maybe that's circumstantial, maybe that's to do with the club, maybe at Real Madrid it would be different. There also, there's a big question mark, I think, which is probably more important than that, which is what happens when Florentino Perez tries to impose certain approaches, shall we say, to the way that Real Madrid set up their squad and play their football that Rafa Benitez doesn't much like. I suppose the response to that would be, well, Rafa Benitez had problems at Valencia and stayed there and put up with it for a while, but did eventually walk away. He's having problems at Liverpool, but so far has put up with it. So maybe he would think, well, it's Real Madrid, a huge, huge club. I'd go there anyway. I don't mean by this, by the way, to say for absolutely for sure that Rafa Benitez is Real Madrid's prime candidate. Right now, I don't think there are any very clear candidates, but he's bound to be on the list, yeah.
Rob's my quick update. Everything going well there?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. All right,
pretty
then, Rob.
Pretty good.
All right. How do you do it, actually? Do you have a technique when you feel yourself going, when you feel the head just beginning to wobble on top of the neck? What's your technique?
Just panic, basically.
Really?
I forget which day I did have a few kind of rocking moments. And
right.
Kind of looked in front and my hand was on the keyboard. Going,
right.
But obviously, being a consummate professional, I quickly woke up, slapped myself about the face a bit. And,
right.
Got on with business.
I've slapped myself about the face. I mean, you know, which of us hasn't? But, you know, in sleep-deprived moments, I remember one very long drive. I shouted at myself quite a lot. But I find...
It's very difficult, isn't it?
It is difficult not to slap yourself.
I remember once when I similarly felt myself going and I thought, well, I'll stand up to ward this off. And my legs just crumpled. I just crumpled.
Right.
Which was, you know...
That's not good, is it?
A moment of triumph. Right. For many.
I find an apple... It's brilliant for just, you know, bringing you that freshness back.
You tell me now.
Yeah, well, because you're only halfway through this mega shift.
And steer clear of those promotional packs of Red Bull that get left around the
office. Yeah, well, no, you can go the rest. Don't have anything with too much sugar, because I think it makes your blood pressure drop. But an apple is very, very good. In fact, somebody once sent me an email suggesting that it contains more natural stimulants than, say, a cup of coffee or tea.
Really?
I know all about sleep deprivation. I've been so deprived of sleep in the past that I actually hallucinated cats walking around me. This was in the middle of the ocean as well. Seriously. True story. One of the many, many shadowy and intriguing facets to my character, but sadly no time to go any further into that. Raphael, Bundesliga, very tight at the top there in Germany.
It is, because the top three sides just keep on winning. Leverkusen won 4-2 against Hamburg, the sort of game where everybody looked for them to bottle it, but they didn't. They played against type or won against type, and huge win against their former coach, of course. Labbadia was there last season. And Schalke inexplicably continue winning as well. They beat Stuttgart on Friday night 2-1.
Why inexplicably?
Because they shouldn't be anywhere near the top. If you look at their squad, it's very mediocre. Felix Magath has brought in lots of youngsters because they had so little money to spend. And this is essentially a side who's been doing absolutely nothing. But under Magath, I don't know what he does with them, but all of a sudden they look very credible. Challenges for the title, and now Bayern seem to take them a lot more seriously than they do Leverkusen. But Bayern still top, thanks to a very late 2-1 reversal, 2-1 win over Freiburg, which really was very flattering. And it was all down to Arjen Robben waking up in the second half, first smacking in a free kick and then scoring second. And they really had him to thank for keeping the title race alive.
Is Robben back to his best now?
He's incredibly good. He's probably better than he's ever played before. Better than his Chelsea
days.
The goal
in Florence was...
It was a fantastic goal. Helped by the wind, perhaps, slightly, as Bastian Schweinsteiger pointed out afterwards. But the thing that he's got now, which he didn't have at Chelsea nor at Real Madrid, is that he's allowed to play on the right, which really helps him because he can cut in. And instead of trying to cross, which is not really his game because he is very selfish, let's face it, he is allowed to run at defenders and shoot. He's already scored 10 and 17 for Bayern, and he's looking absolutely amazing. And if it wasn't for him, Bayern wouldn't be in the Champions League, and they wouldn't be in the title race either.
Mm. Andres Muller's Glorious Shorts writes in, saying, "Dear Raphael, I knew Stefan Effenberg was rather distasteful, but after reading his 2003 classic, I Showed Them All, he is now nailed on for captain of German Worst Football Blokes 11. And he's talking about the keeper of that. What happens in that book that makes him so awful?
Is there suggestive photos with his partner at the time? There's a section with black and white photos where they kiss and do all sorts of stuff, and they're no longer together. Oh. This is the former Mrs. Strunz, of Thomas Strunz's former wife, who ran away with Stefan Effenberg, but now he's back with his old wife. I believe this is a Monday morning. Things might have changed by the time this pod goes out. But I don't know. He's just very forthright. He's a real character. Yeah, never the nicest of blokes. But my hunch is that he was just a bit more honest about what he felt and what he said than most of the people. Just keep quiet.
Don't we in football autobiographies? Is it? I showed them all.
But he was always rather a prickly character. No, I remember the USA '94. No, sent home from
stinker
the
finger affair.
Yeah, that stinky finger is it? Is that what they call it?
Yes.
That's horrible.
They do. Why?
Okay. Well, that puts Gerard and his two, fragrant fingers in perspective, doesn't it? There you go. Andreas Müller's glorious shorts. Thank you for your question. Good. Anything else from the Bundesliga, Raphael?
Yes. I mean, in non-sporting news, I suppose, there was the big scandal, the big story of the weekend is there was a pitch invasion in Berlin after they lost 2-1 at home to Nuremberg. Really a must-win game for them. Now they're 10 points adrift, so they're all but doomed. And about 150 fans stormed the pitch, started demolishing the coaches' benches and basically doing all sorts of mischief. And of course, it didn't look very good on television, and there's a lot of people wondering, you know, what will happen next? Will this now set a bad example for other fans, etc.? So it's a big problem.
Have there been precedents for this, or is this something that
the scale of it has been something quite unprecedented? Certainly in the last decade or so,
right?
We haven't seen anything like that. So that's what really worries people. It was only, as I said, it was only about 150 people. And they had 50,000 in the stadium, but still 150 people wearing hoodies, etc. And they took the flagpoles with them and started hitting at things. There were no people or no stewards or players to hit at because they'd all left. So in their frustration, they took it out on the pitch itself. But, you know, it didn't look good, and there is a feeling that you have to be careful because the ultra movement is beginning to grow in Germany, and while we know that most ultras are more interested in choreography and supporting the team, etc., these things sometimes can attract also the wrong type of fan.
Can people who want to hear more maybe find out in your column?
They can indeed.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you mentioned Italy, I think. Possibly somewhere in there. So let's just quickly check up on everything in Serie A. Another big weekend, Rob Smythe. 39 goals, eh? Try and sleep through that. Poff! That's 3.9 a goal. A game, research indicates. The big result, of course, Inter, as we mentioned back at the start, that 3-1 defeat at Catania, which Juve... Well, what is his position? Lapo Elkin. He's one of the kind of... He's an Agnelli Rampollo. He's an heir to the Agnelli fortune, and as such, is something. He was marketing chief for Fiat, and I think he is for Juventus as well. He has some directorial role. Anyway, he was chortling over Inter losing, saying everyone enjoyed this. Actually, Formica Atomica posting and saying, do all of Italy have the same opinion of Juve patron Lapo Elkin that it was such fun when Inter lost? But he says he would still want them to progress in the Champions League. Also, says Formica Atomica, Lapo looks like a real playboy. He looks like a homeless to me, but my sister says he has something. What do you think, Jace? Raphael, I showed you a picture of Lapo Elkin before. He has something, all right. And as for the playboy business, I'm sure we all recall the 2005 incident when he was found in a transvestite's apartment having taken a cocaine, heroin and something else, cocktail overdose. Yes, he's a man who likes to explore life's possibilities by the sound of it. But a terrific chap, and he's done great work for Fiat and that. And I think he's a real character and the kind of person that Juve need more of. Anyway, there you go, Inter lost, but nobody took advantage, certainly not Juventus, who went 3-0 up in the first 10 minutes against Siena, only for their right back Gagliera to get walked all over by Massimo Macaroni, who brought Siena back into it. I can't remember if he scored all the goals, but anyway, Siena ended up tying 3-3. And Roma, they had their third straight draw, so they didn't pull any points back. They got a point back against Inter. But Milan, despite playing rubbish against Chievo, and Chievo really should have had something from this game, in the, 94th minute, Clarence Seedorf. Whoa, what a fantastic goal. Have you seen this? Anyway, the 1-0 win over Flying Donkeys of Kievo took Milan to within 1 point of Inter at the top of the table. That means they've made up 9 points on Inter in the last 6 games. Crazy. One thing I should quickly mention is that Lazio's disastrous run continues. They lost 2-0 at home to Bari, who had a rubbish away record, but were good enough to beat Lazio at the Stadio Olimpico for the first time in 15 years. And Eddie Rea, the manager, under fire for his choices, particularly his decision to substitute his substitute, Thomas Hitzelberger, who'd actually been playing rather well until that point. And the 50,000 fans at the Olimpico, very upset, and fires lit in the terrace, on the terraces, and all that kind of thing. I think the entire team are now in a punitive training camp to prepare for their next match. The other Italy-related bit of news, of course, is David Beckham, which we're going to talk about in part three. Before we get there, let's whistle through a post or two. TomTom22 wants to talk about the firing of a steward at Old Trafford for trying to return an anti-Glazer banner. Though some people scoff at the scarf-wearing antics of the of the Man United supporters' trust, they do seem to have the Old Trafford directors rattled, Rob Smythe. All this cracking down on people wearing green and gold, etc.
Yeah, hugely. There have been various examples. Even the Wolves stewards were trying the other week to remove a banner, and it was kind of a game of cat and mouse. I suppose they rattled up to a point, but apparently the Glazers, I forget which game, were pointing and laughing.
Well, the Champions League last week, yeah. Perhaps, was it?
It was Avram, yeah, the main game, who, you know, as they went up, you could see him chuckling to himself, which, yeah.
The problem they have now, of course, is that the green and gold has been adopted by people who don't really understand it. It's kind of... It's
David
just...
Beckham, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just an accessory now, and there's a concern that while that will spread the kind of the word of it, it will also dilute its meaning. So
what's its meaning then?
Its meaning is get the Glazers up. But it's more that people, you know, people were wearing it with replica shirts, which kind of defeats the point. So they're trying to undermine the Glazers while also wearing a shirt that's just put 40 quid in their pockets.
Right. It's partly a victim of its own success, the campaign, isn't it? Because as you say, you know, that everyone who all those troop along to Old Trafford now picking up one that's outside the ground and wearing it on top of
their... Yeah, I mean, it was a jester hat yesterday, whenever it was, a green and gold jester hat. Just no.
But it's a really interesting point for the campaign, though, because it was amazing, really, last week, the kind of how vocal it was, how many banners they did manage to get up without them being manhandled out, right. and the impact. Obviously, there was the Beckham moment, whether he knew what he was doing or not, and I think where they go from here is obviously going to be crucial, because, you know, they need to somehow find a way, as you say, of taking those numbers and the mass acceptance it's now got and transforming that into something meaningful that will actually rattle the Glazers. You know?
Yeah, rather than just make them chuckle.
Indeed, so, yeah.
Okay, wow, very good. Now, we mentioned David Beckham. We're going to be talking a little bit more about him and the race for fourth place and that kind of thing right after this. David Beckham, career possibly over now. Are Milan liable, since he was on loan there from the LA Galaxy? Are they liable are they?
Well, I think that's what we've now got to get to the bottom of it. I've been spending half my day on the phone to the States, no doubt, trying to work out exactly what the ins and outs of the contract were. As we know, it was kind of a fairly complex agreement that took him to Milan from LA Galaxy. And LA Galaxy's contract is actually sits with MLS rather than with LA Galaxy. So it'll be quite a contorted... legal discussions going on about who exactly is liable and who owes who money, I would imagine.
Right, and it would, in football terms, is it all down to this bending business that he was so famous for? Is that what's done for the Achilles tendon?
Well, they've had people on Sky Sports News all day, haven't they, with various skeletal models trying to work out exactly why the Achilles tendon could be so weak. But yeah, no, apparently that's the theory, is that because he plants his foot next to the ball and he takes these free kicks in such a way it could have...
Right. Well, he wasn't taking a free kick when it happened.
No.
Rob.
Hello.
Your piece, Beckham Injured, So What? Which I think you probably didn't come up with the title for, but earned you some internet opprobrium, if that's the word, last night.
Yeah.
Something along those lines. But just put in perspective, you were saying it's very sad, but this is not the biggest issue for England right now.
No, Beckham's a good man, and if this is the end of his career, that's... obviously genuinely sad, but it would be a bigger blow to England's hopes of winning the World Cup, such as they are, if Emil Heskey were injured. That's, in my opinion, a fact. It would be a much bigger blow if Heskey, a member of Capello's quite obviously defined best 11, were injured. Beckham was going to contribute, 20 minutes maximum per game. There's this really ridiculous notion that Beckham offers this really kind of tangible plan B, as if all he was going to do, they were going to bring Crouch and Beckham on and just punt it into orbit. I mean, that's ridiculous.
But that's
Beckham,
worked.
No, Beckham would have. No, it hasn't, though. He would have had
there
a role.
There were qualifying matches when he came on. And
one set piece against Ukraine, but essentially what we're talking about is a player who has a cool head and who can distribute the ball well and put cross. But I mean, Crouch doesn't even come on that often. Beckham would have come on just when a game is spread and his distribution might be a factor, but not this whole plan B, launch it to the big man. He might have had an influence, but a very, very small one.
And also, he's been fading fast this year, hasn't he? I mean,
yeah,
I mean,
he looked. Everyone talks about the second leg at Old Trafford, but that was a dead game. The first leg, when it really mattered, he was so far out of his depth, I actually felt sorry for him. And if I feel sorry for someone, well, you know, there you go. I just think that people talk about him being an influence. It's just not relevant. England's right winger is always going to be a pacey player because that's the only place in the front six he can get genuine pace. Now you can argue he doesn't need genuine pace, but this is modern football. Of course you do. Beckham was never going to start games. So while it is very sad, I don't know what people think they're sad about. Is it the end of the career? Yes, that's very sad. The World Cup? It's not really.
I don't know. I'm not David Beckham's biggest fan, but I do see a tactical scenario where opponents of lesser quality, as it did in 2006, play so deep that there is actually nowhere to go, even if you have pace, and you end up lofting it from the halfway line.
Lesser quality is irrelevant. England will always be there. England's problem is beating Brazil and Spain. What's Beckham going to do against them? Well, I mean, Beckham, when he was... All right, he was half fit then, but Beckham at his best did nothing in major tournaments.
I agree with that.
I don't see what Beckham... England's problem is not going to be beating Algeria or even Ghana. It's going to be beating Brazil and Spain. Beckham would not have changed that. He might have put one ball on John Terry's head, but that's a very kind of small percentage.
And as you say, left back, goalkeeper, you know, there are other things to worry about.
I mean, actually, Cole is a much bigger issue.
I think that Glenn you Johnson. Do need. I do think that Capello would have wanted the option. The same way that Jurgen Klinsmann picked David Odonkor, a player who's absolutely useless, can only do one thing, which is run, preferably without the ball. And he scored a goal, the decisive goal. Sorry, he made the decisive goal against Poland, which you say, okay, they would have beaten Poland anyway, but I think it took them to the 80th minute to beat them. And that was the game that settled their progress through the group stage and settled the whole team down. So I don't know. I don't think you can be that dismissive of him.
Mm. All right. Well, whatever. He won't be able to go. Well, it seems extremely unlikely that he would be able to go now. You mentioned the various other problems. In fact, in your article, Rob, when I quote, you say all outfield positions, bar those occupied by Wayne Rooney and Frank Lampard, are greater concerns at the moment. Particularly right wing, though, you say now. You would have thought, looking at the Premier League, that there are plenty of options there. Milner, Walcott, Sean Wright-Phillips.
Milner's a lovely footballer, but the problem you have is that he isn't as dynamic as that position needs to be. Capello has identified it because Gerrard is playing left, then you have Barry Lampard, Rooney, Heskey. So that is the one position where you can get genuine pace.
Right.
That strips you down to... That takes Milner, Bentley and Joe Cole out of the equation.
Yeah.
It leaves you with Walcott and Wright-Phillips, who... Walcott, we know what he did in Croatia, but as Chris Waddle said, I'm not sure he understands football. There's a raw talent there, but whether it's reliable, I don't know. Wright Phillips simply isn't international class. He's a good footballer, but he's not international class. So there's a huge dependence on Lennon. I mean, yesterday, Harry Redknapp said that Lennon, he doesn't know whether he'll be fit. That, to me, is a much bigger story. In pure football terms, that's a much bigger story to Beckham, because Lennon is England's incumbent right winger, and deservedly so.
An interesting day for Adam Johnson then to score that wonder goal for Man City.
A lovely footballer, but again, not the type of player they need, in my opinion.
And probably not quite there yet, you know.
No, exactly. It's a classic English thing, two good games, give him the captaincy, he'll put him in or whatever, you know. But he does look a really good footballer, though.
You just wonder, though, because you said Emil Heskey is much more important to England. Could there be a situation where Rooney scores so many goals that even Capello will be the last man in England to realise that he has to be the central striker, not the number two, and will change the whole format?
Well, that's a really interesting point, though. The fact you have Rooney playing two palpably different roles for club and country. But I just think Capello's invested so much time in the system he has, and it works, as we've seen, up to a point. And he just doesn't have time now. What would he go with Gerrard behind Rooney?
And he's not really a man to admit he's wrong, if you like. I mean, I think having come up with this plan, he'll stick to it.
Basically. Yeah. Mm. In fairness, I don't think he is wrong. I just think Rooney allows both managers
to
be right.
Both, but,
Well, all fascinating stuff. But to finish off, let's just turn our attention back to the Premier League and the battle for fourth. Spurs, their victory over Rovers keeps them in fourth spot. City have a game in hand, but they're 2 points behind. Liverpool, a further 2 points behind without a game in hand. Aston Villa have two in hand over Spurs and are 6 points back. Any chance that Villa Because sometimes they're not always included in this little battle. Are they contenders here still?
In my opinion, no. I think they traditionally fade this time of the season. That hasn't happened to quite such an extent this week and this season. And in isolation, Stoke away is a good point, but they have some hard fixtures, a relatively slim squad. I don't see them finishing.
But the interesting thing about this battle for fourth is that you could say that about every team, couldn't you? You know, you wouldn't beat a house in any of them.
You could, but if you look at the run-ins, I know it's slightly dangerous. Liverpool have quite an easy one. They have Chelsea and United to play, but that aside, they have nobody in the top eight. They have Fulham, who can be hard at Craven Cottage, but they have them at home. I think Liverpool will get there fairly comfortable.
Well, there are some who say that Liverpool may not even finish sixth, and that
let's hope so. No, I just think the run-ins are so important. You know, people just look at games and say, "What? How many games you have left?" But the fact that Liverpool have all but two of their games are essentially winnable. In fact, they should win. They would win them 9 times out of 10.
Well, they should, but there's been lots of games like that this season that they haven't. That's, you know, true. And you wonder if the malaise starts to take hold, and you know, talk of Torres leaving.
That's true. I just thought there were really good signs with Torres in the game in the week. He was sulking still, which he has all season.
Lille?
But I just thought he was revving up towards something resembling his best. I thought he looked quite sharp.
Just the 1-0 defeat away to Lille.
But they played quite well. Let's not be disingenuous, Jim. I thought they played quite well in that game. They, you know, it was a freak goal, and Lille aren't a bad side. And Torres, there were just signs that with the run of games, he's getting somewhere near his best, just in time to play his old friend Nemanja Vidic at the weekend.
And as you say, you know, kind of the pressure of the run-in is such a factor, because you know you wouldn't necessarily back Spurs not to crumble. Man City, the, you know, the pressure there is so great as part of the City project, if you like, that, you know, I think that will start to tell as well. And you know, you're just looking at them at the weekend as well, they just weren't convincing again, were they?
I would say Liverpool are the only side, I'm not saying they will, but who have the capacity to win 6 or 7 in a row.
They haven't won 2 in a row since when?
But hold on a minute. City were totally convincing. That game was a freak result that did not reflect the match at all. I mean, Craig Gordon made unbelievable saves, and they should have won the game absolutely comfortably in the second half. And, you know, they've got Wigan, Burnley and Fulham, I think, in the next three. And they're actually the least defeated team in the league.
Interesting.
The most difficult team to beat. They've only lost 4. So, you know, this image that we've got of them, of this sort of diva team that, you know, doesn't turn up, is actually not true. They either win or they draw. They just have drawn too many games. But for me, they're still way ahead of everyone else when it comes to that fourth spot.
Is there also a case that they are the club that out of Spurs, City, Liverpool and Villa would have the best chance of actually maintaining a top four role if they do crack the Champions League?
Financially, you'd have to say that was the case, wouldn't you? You know, and once they have, that's the key for them, is pulling themselves up into that four, basically. And then once you've done that, as we've seen, you know, in recent seasons, it does become self-perpetuating. If they could get there once, getting there second time is the key, and then from then on.
It's not inconceivable that if they finish top four this season, they could be European champions within 2 years. I think that's with the money they have. It might seem absurd now, but so it is very important. Whereas if they finish fifth, it might put them back, I don't know, 2 or 3 more years. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how that pans out. Right. And of course, Mancini as well. If they don't finish fourth, will he survive? I suspect probably not.
All right, final question then. Liverpool, are they going to get past Lille on Thursday? Owen?
Yes.
Rob, you're confident.
I do care passionately. I think they will, yeah.
I don't think they will, but we'll see. We'll see, eh? We'll be back on Thursday prior to that game with reviews of all the midweek Champions League action and, of course, Wigan's clash with Aston Villa, one of their many games in hand. Do join us for that. In the meantime, many, many thanks, Owen, for being with us today. And you too, Raphael Honigstein.
Thank you.
You, Rob, what a trooper, man. What a soldier.
Thank you.
All right, then. And producer Ben. And we'll speak to you on Thursday.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.